This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. If you're a pet owner, you know your dog, and I know my cat, can get jealous from time to time. They might give you a little nudge if you're petting another animal, or they might bark or hiss at you to get your attention. So if an animal can be jealous, can it also get depressed or go mad? And if an animal can go mad, what does that say about their mental state and their ability for self-awareness? My next guest has explored the inner lives of animals from mental illness to recovery and says that their mental state might mirror our own. Laurel Breitman is author of the new book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. If you've noticed a mental illness in any of your animals, call us at 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Laurel Breitman, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're going to start by talking about your dog, Oliver, who's somebody that you write about throughout the course of your book, who suffered from mental illness. Can you describe Oliver and his case and what exactly his diagnosis was?
Sure. He was dashing, charming, gorgeous, affectionate, a true pleasure to be around, at least for the first 6 months that I knew him. He was a rescue, and about 6 months in, he developed debilitating separation anxiety, meaning that my ex-husband and I, we couldn't leave him alone without him panicking and freaking out. He was also diagnosed with a thunderstorm phobia. He hallucinated. He became aggressive with other dogs and sometimes small children. And he would even eat things that weren't food. So he really had a whole host of issues.
He had all these issues. And as you started to look at all the issues that Oliver had, what got you interested in exploring this more deeply? Obviously, every pet owner knows that his or her pet has some interesting behaviors, but you were looking much more deeply at this.
Yeah, I mean, I've always lived with dogs and other animals. I grew up on a farm. There was always other creatures there. And had you asked me 10 years ago if dogs could have emotions, you know, I wasn't a doubter. I definitely would have said yes. But had you asked me if dogs could develop anxiety disorders, or if parrots could develop OCD, or that an elephant could have post-traumatic stress disorder, I would have been a little bit skeptical, you know, and thought that that sounded awfully anthropomorphic. But when my own dog developed all of these issues, I really had to try and understand what was going on with him in order to help him. He was about 120 pounds, and he did things like once he jumped out of our house. We lived on the third floor of a brownstone in Washington, D.C. He jumped 55 feet and in a panic, and he survived. And in the face of that, I really had to figure out how to help him and took him to a veterinary behaviorist who gave him a Prozac prescription and a Xanax prescription. And I was just starting my PhD in history of science at that time. I was reading a lot of Darwin, and Charles Darwin and some of his colleagues were saying that other animals could lose their minds. And here I was, you know, refilling my dog's Prozac prescription at CVS. And I wondered, and it shocked me. And I wanted to know what had happened. If this wasn't big news for Darwin, what had happened in the intervening 150 years that I was shocked that my dog could wind up with a prescription?
It might have shocked Darwin that you were giving your dog a prescription, but that's something else. I'm wondering how a doctor gives an animal a diagnosis. I mean, you don't know what an animal is thinking. It's obviously hard enough to diagnose people with mental illness. So how are these diagnoses made?
Yeah, well, it's not as weird as you might think. You know, it's pretty recent that we think that in order to understand emotional suffering in a person, we have to talk to them about it. You know, that's really, we owe that to the rise of psychoanalysis in the early 20th century. And before that, physicians often diagnosed emotional suffering in other people by observation, noticing things like racing heartbeat and their startle response, and if they seem to have changed from how they were before whatever incident might have set them down the path to emotional distress. So it's also actually how we diagnose suffering in children. And I don't know about you, but in most of my human relationships, particularly when I'm dating, just because you ask someone how they feel doesn't mean that they're going to tell you. So there's really always a lot of guesswork and empathy involved with trying to understand those of us around us, even if we share the same language.
In your book, you take a look back at how animals and people have interacted around some of these issues, going back to, I don't know, the Victorian era where bears were diagnosed with homesickness. I guess I'm wondering how far we've come in the way we think about animals in captivity and their mental state around us.
Yeah, I mean, there was just this study that came out last week about, you know, dogs showing what looks like jealousy. A few weeks before that, there was a, you know, a piece that came out about crawdads responding to anti-anxiety medication. And we are in some ways living in this kind of flowering of studies on non-human animal emotional complexity. But I actually don't think it's all that new in so many ways. It's really just the ways that we're getting at their emotional experiences have changed. We're doing things like putting them dogs inside of MRI machines. But I don't think any of this would surprise anyone who actually works with dogs, or a zookeeper who, say, works with gorillas, or a parrot rehabilitator. People who spend their daily lives with other animals, particularly those people that have them as colleagues, really never tend to find this stuff shocking.
We're talking with Laurel Breitman, who's the author of Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Tell us the story of a gorilla named Gigi that you profile in the book.
Oh, sure. I'm a huge admirer of Gigi. Gigi is a resident of Boston, and she has a psychiatrist who's human and who is on staff at the Harvard Medical School. He also has a private practice not far from the zoo in Boston. And Gigi received a, more than 10 years ago now, a young male came to the zoo in Boston, and he really beat up on Gigi, and it really wasn't his fault. He was kind of too young to be moved and to be sent there. And he did the best he could, but he became really aggressive with her, and he did things like tear open her scalp and tried to drown her in the moat and in their shared exhibit. And to their great credit, the keeper staff there were really distressed and concerned because Gigi was starting to behave in ways that reminded them of, you know, a trauma response. She would scream and cry. She had nightmares. She wouldn't sleep at night. She stopped eating and being social. And so they called in a human psychiatrist to try and help her. And he put her on a variety of anti-anxiety and antidepressant medications, some of which helped a little bit. But in the end, sadly, what really helped was isolating the male that was beating up on her. I say sadly because he ended up being on his own for more than 10 years, which is not something a male gorilla loves. And recently, a few years ago, he was reintroduced back to Gigi. And in the intervening years, she's become so much more confident. And she's also raised a few young females herself inside the zoo. And they now protect her. So she's in with him every other day, and she seems to be fine. And she hasn't been on anti-anxiety or antidepressants in a very, very long time, although her psychiatrist still brings his psychiatry students at Harvard Med in to see her.
Let's get to some phone calls, and people want to share some of their stories about animals who've had some of the same problems you write about. Dawn is in Washington, D.C. Hi there, Dawn.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I was just wondering what sort of medications or help did she get for her dog, because I have a dog, Ziggy, who is in a very, very similar situation. I've tried all of the medications that the vets have given me. I even got another dog to keep him company for the separation anxiety, and he still just goes crazy when I leave, scratching at the door. He's broken off toenails. He's hurt himself a couple of times. So, yeah, what have you found successful?
Don, first of all, I'm just so sorry to hear that. You know, I think in a lot of ways, I spent 7 years researching this book, and I wrote it, and I really think it was an effort just to make myself feel less guilty and alone, frankly. You know, there's so many of us, we fall in love with creatures, and we realize, you know, maybe 6 months in or a year in that they have these issues, and it's too late. You know, we already love them. And then, yes, sometimes you try everything, and it doesn't help. In the end, you know, my own dog died, but we did try in a panic-related incident. We did, though, try all kinds of things, you know, from herbs to behavior therapy to way more exercise. I do think exercise often helps. If the dog is too tired to be anxious, that can help. But in extreme cases, it just doesn't help. And finding somewhere where your dog is never left alone is the answer. But how many of us can do that? Really, there's no, just like there is with humans, there's no one-size-fits-all remedy to emotional suffering in non-human animals. You know, psychopharmaceuticals will help some of us. They won't help others. The companionship of another creature is great. You got another dog. One thing that I found, you know, I often felt like a service animal for my own dog. You know, I wanted a little vest. I felt like I was, you know, mediating his experience in the world and trying to protect him. And I think that's really one thing that humans do spectacularly well. It gives me hope. You know, so you've got him a dog. You're his own service animal. You know, I would keep trying. I would keep trying everything under the sun.
It's interesting.
And then be nice to yourself.
Yeah, this idea of it really takes two to be a companion animal, a human and the animal, because the animal needs you maybe as much as you need the animal.
Yes, and one thing that is so amazing that I just loved while researching the book was often, you know, a therapy animal is the same species or is an entirely different species. You know, I get so many internet forwards, probably so many of us do, you know, hound dog and orangutan make great friends, or dog and elephant become buddies. And I always looked at those kind of skeptically and thought they were staged or just too achingly anthropomorphic. But what I've figured out is actually there's really something to that. You know, when we are distressed, and sometimes even if we're not, you know, if we're social animals, we're going to reach out to those around us who make us feel better, whether it's a wombat or a wallaby or a person often. And it helps.
This idea of anthropomorphizing animals, doing it well and doing it badly, you actually support the idea to a certain extent in your book, something that an awful lot of researchers want to distance themselves from. Why is that? Why do you think it's okay in some ways to anthropomorphize?
Well, it's not as if you can take your human brain out of your head and put it in a jar and then use it to think about other animals thinking. We will always be one animal wondering and thinking and using our perspective to try and understand the emotional experience of another creature. So I would like us just to be honest about that sort of give up on this idea of this kind of like untainted, pure scientific objectivity that allows us to think clearly about other animals. You know, we often can't, particularly when we care for those animals. And I think that's a good thing. I think people really shouldn't feel so ashamed as they often do. You know, we all have a secret voice we use to talk for our dog or cat or parrot or what have you when no one's at home, you know. A lot of us are really embarrassed about that. And I really think people should embrace that side of themselves, because it often helps us help the creatures that we care for. No one knows your animals better than you. And a lot of this kind of noticing of abnormal behavior and then helping them really depends on you having a really good idea of what normal is in the animal that you know. That isn't to say, though, that wildlife don't suffer from emotional thunderstorms and distress. They absolutely do. But when it comes to actively intervening and trying to help someone, anthropomorphism can really help. As long as you don't do it self-centeredly.
I just want to say I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And I want to go back to another quick phone call. Gregory is calling from Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hi there, Gregory.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I have a cat, and ironically, her name's Ophelia. We didn't know she was going to be crazy when we named her.
Oh, dear.
But she's 18 years old. And she has an extremely noticeable obsessive-compulsive disorder where if you pet her, as soon as she starts to purr, she walks away and she has to find a metal bedpost and she starts licking it. And then she does her little standing in a circle and walking around. And then she has to bite paper. And then she lets you pet her. And if she didn't get enough satisfaction from licking the bedpost and walking on the paper, she repeats it over and over and over again until she's finally satisfied. And I was just wondering, has that ever come up before? Is it something detrimental to the cat? Should we just enjoy it while we have it?
Well, and Gregory, thank you very much for the question. You write a lot about animal OCD in your book.
I do. It's actually a relatively common problem in us and in other creatures, because most OCD behaviors are actually healthy animal activities. And this is true with fear and anxiety disorders as well. They're healthy animal activities or emotional experiences gone awry. So a lot of OCD behaviors in people and other animals are, say, grooming behaviors, you know, overwashing your hands or paws. In your case, oh my goodness, what rituals, you know. Yes, we are not the only animals to engage in rituals. It depends how much this, your cat's rituals are keeping her from normal activities that she likes. So if she's engaging in these behaviors to the extent that she's not eating or she's not socializing or she seems anxious, then I would seek help. Also, just out of curiosity, I don't know if you have access to the internet, but I've spent many a long hour putting OCD cat into the search field on YouTube, and you will find a world of obsessive compulsive cats and their odd behaviors. Cats who have to touch various things before they eat, cats who turn in circles only a certain number of times, cats who can't stand wrinkles in rugs, and so they'll spend a very long time trying to press wrinkles out of things. I mean, the animal kingdom is just so much more bizarre and wonderful than you could possibly imagine.
And of course, YouTube is there for us to see it in all of its glory. Laurel Breitman is the author of Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/animalmadness. Thanks so much, Laurel.
Thank you so much.